This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Many of us may not be able to point to Mali on a map, but this landlocked nation in West Africa has emerged as a crisis. Here's a quick synopsis. A government once hailed as a model of democracy collapses in a coup last March. Three northern provinces, an area the size of Texas, break away and declare themselves independent. Radical Islamists take over and impose a harsh form of Sharia law. Refugees flee. Jihadist groups gather. Mali's neighbors propose to train and equip a small force to intervene, but the UN Security Council has yet to approve that plan. And Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, dismisses it as, quote, crap. If you've ever spent time in Mali, call and tell us what we don't know about this country. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, the big dogs establish a new world order in the NCAA. But first, the crisis in Mali. We begin with Sudarshan Raghavan, Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He's just returned to his base in Nairobi from a visit to Mali and joins us by phone. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here, Dale. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Is there one story I wonder if you heard on your visit to Mali that explains the depth of the problem there?
Sure. I mean, what we're seeing now is that the Islamists have in northern Mali have becoming more and more increasingly brutal with the local population. One particular story that really struck me, quite shocking actually, was a woman I interviewed who basically was dragged from her home, beaten up, taken to the police headquarters and thrown in jail, and was facing a punishment of 100 lashes with an electrical cord. And for what reason? All because she was giving water to a man who was not her relative. In northern Mali, I mean, such mundane actions lead to severe punishments for the local population, and that's really contributing to this vast, massive exodus from northern Mali to the south as well as to neighboring countries.
Who are these radical Islamists? Are they of that population? Are they from Mali or are they from outside?
Well, it's a mix. There are essentially three groups now who control northern Mali. You have a group called Ansar al-Din, who are mostly comprised of hardline Islamists, many of them Malian, as well as moderates. You also have a group called Mujal, basically, and they are essentially foreigners who are an offshoot of the al-Qaeda affiliate in North and West Africa. And then you have the al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate, and they've been around for a long time. They've essentially funded their activities through kidnapping Westerners, which they've derived millions of dollars from, as well as they play a significant role in the drug trafficking trade from West Africa through the north to Europe.
And what's this part of the world like?
Well, this part of the world is geographically it's a very barren, vast stretches of desert. As you mentioned earlier, it's the size of Texas, and this is what's really raising a lot of concerns because you're having these radical Islamists create a haven for jihadists to possibly target the West or to continue their criminal activities in an area that's geographically impenetrable for conventional armies. And that's why that's one of the questions that have risen recently over the capability or the possibility of an African force, which is being recommended to take over to try and liberate northern Mali. The geography of this region is going to be a significant concern to any sort of military intervention that could happen there.
Well, more on that later. But what about the Malian government? Bamako is the capital down in the south. And we read that just this week, the prime minister who took over in that coup in March was himself deposed.
That's correct. There's significant political turmoil in Bamako. You have the military leaders who took over in the March coup. They were very unhappy with the prime minister. They just didn't feel that he was in line with their vision for the country. In particular, their vision for retaking northern Mali. The military has long wanted to take the lead in such an operation, and there's a matter of pride in this as well, because they were, in fact, the ones who lost the north. But the prime minister has been quite active in recent weeks in trying to generate international support for a military intervention, which just didn't sit well with the Malian military.
And are there distinctions between the population in and around the capital of Bamako and the populations in northern provinces in and around places like Timbuktu?
The main difference is they do speak different languages. In the south they mostly speak the Bambara language, and whereas in the north it's a whole different sorts of languages like Songhai. But what you're seeing now is that you're seeing and the entire population of the north now living around the Bamako area and a place like Sfigu, which is north of Bamako, and Mopti. By some estimates, half the entire population of Timbuktu, this fabled historic city, that is now living in the south. So, you're really seeing this vast exodus, massive exodus of people leaving the north, who are now living with either with their relatives in the south or other refugees. It's a pretty grim situation.
And you mentioned Timbuktu. It's the site of many world historical sites, Sufi shrines. They, however, in action reminiscent of the destruction of the Buddhas in Afghanistan by the Taliban, they're being destroyed.
That's correct. The Islamists, they are really shattering the soul of this very significant historical city. And it's not just the shrines that are being destroyed. The Islamists have even targeted musicians. Northern Mali, especially the area on Timbuktu, has had a rich tradition of music that has been, basically been eviscerated now. I spoke to, many musicians who fled the north, particularly Timbuktu, who are now living in Bamako and really, without jobs. Really, it's a very desperate situation. And there's a great amount of anger. I mean, people are just, they're being targeted simply for singing, which Mali was never like that before. Mali is for centuries has been a very moderate Islamic country, and as one human rights activist told me, the Islamists have basically taken the joie de vivre out of the people there.
Here's an email to that point from Katie in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. I spent several weeks in Mali in 2007 studying music with Umu Sangare and Nebe Solo. I apologize if I mispronounced their names. At that time, every Malian I met told me how it was the safest, nicest country on the continent, and from everything I could see, they were right. What a shame that a country that had just attained stability in 1991 would be put through this turmoil again. If you've been to Mali, call and tell us what we don't know about this country. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Robert's on the line with us from Nashville.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I went to Mali in January of 2011 to attend a very famous festival in the desert. I joined a travel group that traveled from Bamako to Timbuktu. We took a three-day boat ride up the Niger River. And the specific reason I went there was for the Festival of the Desert. And at that time, the State Department of the United States and of European countries had warned people to not go to the Festival of the Desert because of the threat of Al-Qaeda kidnappings. Me being either the adventurous type or reckless type, depending on your point of view, I went anyway. And I had a great experience, but one reason I didn't feel too unsafe was because the Tuareg nomads were the ones who were sponsoring the festival. So it was in their best interest not to let any violence happen to Westerners, because that was a cash cow for them each year. But I'll tell you, it was very, very spooky. sitting at midnight on a sand dune watching Tanaru win on the stage. And on either side of me were sitting Tuareg nomads, totally covered in the indigo blue turbans. I could only see their faces, and they would look at me, and I'm thinking, okay, don't be nervous. These guys aren't going to do any harm. But it's kind of spooky because they all wear daggers and chains around their necks. I just think it's very, very sad that this is happening because it's such a Mali's considered the birthplace of the American blues. And I just think it's very tragic this is happening because it's such a wonderful, beautiful, fabulous country.
Robert, thanks very much for the story. We're glad you made it out.
All right. Thank you.
So long. And he's used an important word, Siddharsan Raghavan. Tuaregs, they are nomads who, well, they're not just in Mali, but a lot of North African countries. And it was they who, in the latest version of a rebellion, tried to form an independent state in northern Mali.
That's correct. You know, the Tuaregs in the north have been, for years, decades, have been marginalized by the southerners in the south. And the original rebellion was, in fact, started by Tuareg separatists, and they were, you know, helped by other Tuaregs who once fought for the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, and they returned back to the north. With carrying, you know, many of Gaddafi's weapons, and they used that to really to push out the military, which is also facing a power vacuum of its own down the south, and essentially took it over. But what happened after that was the Islamists, especially the Al-Qaeda militants, essentially, which had basically piggybacked on this Tuareg rebellion, essentially pushed the Tuaregs out of power. And now what you're seeing is it's the Islamists who are now in control over all the major cities in the north, and the Tuaregs have once again been marginalized by the Islamists
After a short break, a look at what the international community plans for Mali. If you've spent time there, call. Tell us, what don't we know about Mali? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. In Mali, soldiers forced the prime minister's resignation early Tuesday. Though the interim president since has named a new prime minister, it's not likely to inspire much confidence across Africa or the globe, where the country's instability is a pressing concern. If you've been to Mali, we want to hear from you. What don't we know about this country? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Today we're catching up on the latest in Mali and plans to intervene there. And there are other news stories from 2012 you'd like us to revisit before this year is out. Send us your suggestions. Email us, talk@npr.org. Put 2012 news in the subject line and join us this hour on Thursday for Closing the Circle on some stories from 2012. Siddharsan Raghavan, Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, is our guest. Let's see if we get another caller in. And this is Siddiqui. Siddiqui calling us from Tampa.
Hey, Neil.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Good. I like your program, and I'm very happy you guys are bringing this to the attention of the international community, you know. So the problem with the country, why are the international community trying to help Mali to get rid of these terrorists? Because if you don't face them now, we're going to have to face them in the future. I mean, I'm living in the United States, I hear a lot of talk about Syria, Libya, but I don't hear enough attention by the government, you know, to these problems.
Where in Mali are you from?
I'm from Bamako.
The capital?
Yes.
What do you think of the situation there? It's chaotic, to say the least.
It's chaotic because it's everybody is trying to get their own. It's corruption. You know, everybody's worried about themselves instead of the country.
And so everybody's out for their own and nobody's looking out for the national interest.
Exactly.
And what about this idea of a separate country in the north?
That's impossible, because if you give these guys you divide a country, why divide a country? I mean, people are trying to get together in this period. I mean, look at the European Union, look at the United States. divided, you know, we don't make it.
Look at Southern Sudan. That may be the only solution eventually.
Well, Sudan is not as stable because I have friends from Sudan. Sudan, there is problem between the north and the south.
No, there's a lot of instability there, too. You're right about that. Thank you very much for the call, Siddiqui.
Okay.
Joining us now is J. Peter Pham, director of the Atlantic Council's Michael S. Anson Africa Center, and he's on the phone with us from New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks for having me.
And a group of Mali's neighbors, ECOWAS, as the regional grouping is known, they have proposed a plan. What's the idea here?
Well, the idea is they're concerned. They feel that if they don't contain the problems that my friend has spoken about in northern Mali, those problems aren't contained, it's going to spread to their countries, and that's a very realistic fear. The problem is that the plan that they've put forward is not particularly realistic. You talked earlier about how large of an area that the Islamists have seized control of, yet the neighboring African states are proposing an intervention force of about 3,300 troops, drawn from sub-Saharan Africa, areas that are not sharing the same type of climate and geography. They're unused to this warfare. They'll have to be trained for desert warfare. And even once they're trained and equipped, 3,300 troops are not going to take back an area the size of Texas. That's not even funny to think that that would be possible. So that's part of the issue, is that the international community needs to do something to contain this problem. It's a very real problem. It's even reached our shores, but we don't have yet the political will to put together a force that's credible.
And I was just going to say, this plan has been proposed to the Security Council, which would have to approve it. It has yet to do so. And as we said earlier, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, described the plan as crap.
Yes, and Ambassador Rice, I think perhaps maybe have been less diplomatic, but she's being certainly frank about it. It's showing a lack of seriousness on the part of the neighbors. They want to take the lead, but they're not willing to put the political capital, much less the troops, in the line that they need to in order to take that lead.
Sudarshan Raghavan, let's go back to you in Nairobi after your recent trip to Bamako in Mali. The ECOWAS grouping, the largest and most powerful of Mali's neighbors, is Nigeria. They have, of course, a fight with some Islamists of their own.
That's correct. I mean, they're fighting the militants of the Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. And they're facing an uphill battle there as well. So it remains to be seen how much Nigeria, in particular, will be willing to send in troops into northern Mali when they have problems in their own backyard. There have been analogies made that Somalia might serve as a model for any potential military intervention into northern Mali. But you have to remember that in Somalia, all of the neighbors that really were involved, have been involved in fighting back the al-Shabaab Islamists there, didn't really have too many threats in their own backyard. I mean, they were freed up to go tackle the issues in Somalia. It's not the same case with Mali's neighbors.
And Ethiopia and Kenya, the two militaries that intervened for the most part in Somalia, much better equipped and much better trained than their West African neighbors. And J. Peter Pham, that raises another question. What's the alternative?
Well, several things need to be done. First, certainly we have to focus at this moment less on intervention in the north and more on realistically containing the threat there. That's small consolation for the people who, as Sudarshan has written about and spoken about, who are being ground under by the brutal rule in the north. But being realistic, we have to worry first about containment, and then we'll talk about rollback. Secondly, we have to worry about reestablishing some sort of legitimate rule in Bamako. The military is still trying to pull strings behind the scenes. The government, governing elites, are largely discredited. And as you said in the last segment, you talked about how the Tuaregs have been marginalized both politically in the past and now sidelined by the extremists. If you're going to ever retake the North, it's going to be with some help from people in the North who don't want the extremists. But they're not going to, if they, they're going to be able to negotiate a deal with the government in Bamako. It has to be a legitimate government. Otherwise, you know, they've had three failed peace deals with legitimate governments. Why would anyone negotiate with a government that's illegitimate? And I think the third thing we need to look about, Sudarshan just spoke about Nigeria being the big neighbor. The other big neighbor in this equation is Algeria. And though I don't like analogies because analogies are imperfect, in a way, Algeria plays a role not unlike that of Pakistan in Afghanistan. On one hand, they don't want extremists. They've had their own battles with them. But it suits their purposes to have the extremists off in northern Mali rather than in Algeria. And so Algeria, which has a large border, about the longest border with Mali, has allowed, tacitly allowed, extremists from other parts of the world to travel across their country to get there. They allow the supply lines, the fuel lines, to run into northern Mali. They keep the extremists able to carry out the attacks they are and the repression. So in a way, Algeria needs to be both part of the solution, but we have to recognize it's also part of the problem.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Let's go to Alyssa. Alyssa with us from Denver.
Yep, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. You were just asking a little bit about the what's missing in this conversation or what do we need to know more about Mali. And I was in the Peace Corps in Mali. I was there actually when the coup happened. And we were evacuated from the country, taken out. So I was ended up being there for 21 months and really definitely got to know the people that were living there and feel like that's what's really missing here is the people in Mali are so warm and welcoming. It's the most peaceful way of Islam and Muslim culture that I've experienced. And I'm actually from Dearborn, Michigan, not saying that that's also not a peaceful place, but I just felt so warm and welcomed there. And for me, hearing things about Sharia law and hearing that they're saying no more music, no more dance, that's one of the biggest parts of Malian culture. And it's just really, really upsetting for me, and I know all of the other people that I was there with, to hear that those things are not being allowed anymore.
Were you living in a village when you were in Mali, Alyssa?
Yeah, I was living in the San Segu region of Mali, so my village was about 500 people. It was pretty little.
Describe it. What was it like?
Oh, man. It was, there was no electricity, no running water, and the people just lived life there. They danced, they sang, they, you know, welcomed people into their homes for food, and it was nonstop talking there. There was always tea and wanting to know more about America and what my life was there and if I owned that airplane and, you know, all of the crazy things. They just don't know anything about America because they've never experienced, pretty much all of them had never experienced anything outside of their village.
Thank you very much for that description, and we're sorry that such terrible things are happening there.
Yeah, it's a really upsetting thing for all of us that were there. So
appreciate it. Jay Peter Pham, you spoke a moment ago about an analogy to Pakistan. Algeria, you said, was playing somewhat of an analogous role. And some people might say, well, Mali, it can be contained, a landlocked country far away. It can pose no threat to anybody else outside. Of course, that description could also apply to Afghanistan.
Yes, and it's already attracting jihadists and other extremists and wannabes as well. Interestingly, just yesterday in the Southern District of Alabama, the FBI arrested and the U.S. attorney brought indictments against two U.S. citizens, a fellow named Mohammed Abdurrahman Abdulkader and another fellow named Randy Wilson, who goes up by Rashid Wilson, who were arrested as they were planning to travel. They were going to fly to Morocco, travel down to Mauritania, and cross over into northern Mali to receive training and from the extremists who are there now. It's already become a magnet. These two were stopped, but we know of fighters coming from the Sahrawi, from the western part of the Sahara, to Sudanese, and others are coming there. So there, it is an area that is active, and they're well-resourced. Arms flow freely through this area, thanks in part to the arsenals put aside by the late Muammar Gaddafi, but they've also made a lot of money. These these extremists in the north have made millions over the last decade in ransom, so they have a nice war chest, as well as the money they made in illicit trade in everything from cocaine to cannabis resin.
Sudarshan Raghavan, though, if what we're hearing, if music and dance are such an integral part of Malian society, eventually these people are not going to tolerate this kind of intimidation.
Yes, you would think so. I mean, in fact, you know, there have been reports in the north about people protesting some of the actions, the brutal actions by the Islamists. But for the moment, the Islamists are basically in command. They have absolute power. And from my conversations with people fleeing there, it seems that they are increasing their brutality. And as one, the former mayor of Gao, the northern town, told me, that, you know, as the longer, you know, the international community waits, the longer there isn't a solution to the problems in the north, the more these Islamists are going to take advantage, the more they're going to terrorize the population, and really solidify their control over the north, and that's a major concern of many Malians right now.
Sudarshan Raghavan is the Washington Post's Africa Bureau Chief, and also with us, J. Peter Pham, Director of the Atlantic Council's Michael S. Ansari Africa Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Tua. Tua with us from Cincinnati.
Oh, hi, Neil. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a comment here.
Go ahead.
I really would like to see the International Committee to Help Mali, especially United States here, because, when Obama government went after Gaddafi, and that's when everything starts. So Mali people, we don't know war. We don't know what is war. The last war I remember, that was like I was in elementary school, and that was with Burkina Faso, neighbor country. And it was not a fun thing to experience. So now I have 4 kids in Cincinnati here. I would like to see my kids see Mali one day and talk about my culture, everything. So I really want Mali to be back to normal. It's the most peaceful country in the western, part of Africa. So if Obama government can do something, that'd be great. My mom is Tuareg. My dad was born in Tombuctu. So I know what everybody's talking about, but, we still want peace. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much for the call, and we wish you and your family good luck.
Thanks.
And J. Peter Pham, as you listen to her, the situation in Mali is an unintended spillover from the intervention in Libya. What can the United States do?
Well, what we can do is somewhat limited at the moment. Because of the overthrow of the constitutional government in the coup last year, by law, we cannot directly assist the Malian government until it gets the democratic transition back to constitutional order. Unfortunately, we had the setback this week with the forced resignation of the transitional prime minister, Cheikh Modou Diarra. So we have to get that back on track. So what the U.S. was planning to do was to assist Mali indirectly by assisting the building up of an African Union, African-led regional force. But the problem with that has been that, as we've discussed earlier, Mali's neighbors are not being very forthcoming. The plan they're proposing is not realistic. And so we're searching around for partners to work with, and that's the biggest problem. The Malian military itself needs to be retrained. It's a very small army. Mali never really had major enemies to require a large army, but that small army has also been corrupted by the coup as well. So it's a difficult task, and unfortunately it's one that's going to require, I know everyone is desirous of a very quick solution, but realistically, I would not be surprised if it would well into late next year before we saw any real military action, because it's going to take time to train and equip forces. In the meantime, we have to continue on the track of the diplomacy to reach out to those in the north who are disaffected by the extremists, as well as the political track to restore orderly democracy. and constitutional rule to Bamako, something the Malian people themselves should be very proud of having had in the past, and I'm sure many of them will want to restore it as soon as possible.
I'd like to end with this email from Vicky in Gainesville. As an art historian who's conducted research in Mali since 1999, one when I did my doctoral research in Bamako, more recently, I've worked in Timbuktu's rich traditions of embroidery. It's a wonderful place. If this sort of political and religious turmoil can occur there, it can occur anywhere. My friends there are stunned by these recent events. This is in no way reflective of this country's long history of open, globally oriented culture. It's unbelievable and should be a source of serious concern for people everywhere. I pray for a return to stability and real democracy. Sudarshan Raghavan and J. Peter Pham, thank you both very much for your time. We appreciate it. When we come back, it's Mike Pesca, and we're talking about the NCAA. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.